Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
President Trump calls a truce in his trade war with the European Union, and we'll give you an update on where the NAFTA renegotiations stand. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board here in Manhattan, and it is Friday, the day that we bring you outside experts in all aspects of foreign policy, military, economic, and more. And so today is on trade, and I'm happy to welcome back one of the nation's experts, Dan Eikenson, the director of the Cato Institute's Herbert A. Stiefel Center for Trade Policy Studies in Washington. Thanks for coming back on the show, Dan.
Thank you so much, Mary. I appreciate this.
So this week, President Trump held a press conference with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, and he announced essentially a truce, an agreement to hold off on certain tariffs and to talk about opening up more trade between these two very large jurisdictions. We on the editorial page, big picture, saw this as a very positive development, not really a win of the United States over Brussels, but more of an avoidance of what we called mutually assured destruction. Dan, do you agree?
I think it's an important development. And those of us who are in favor of trade have been hungering for some sort of positive development to point to. And the fact that they had face time together is good. The rhetoric was getting exceptionally heated. I'm glad that the meeting ended with, an agreement to talk. But I got to say, I do think there is a little too much is being attached to the meaning of what was agreed and what wasn't agreed. Really, there's no commitments to do anything. There's a broad pledge to achieve zero tariffs and zero non-tariff barriers in non-automotive trade and to achieve zero subsidies. Now, these are fine objectives. Free traders would support that any day of the week. And under the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership negotiations that have sort of gone into a cryogenic state in the past couple of years, those things were, on the table already. So what happened Wednesday, we've seen an escalation in the rhetoric associated with, President Trump's protectionist actions. A few months ago, he imposed duties on aluminum and steel. And the Europeans are not happy about that. They have retaliated. And hanging in the balance right now is a similar national security case involving automobiles and the specter of duties being imposed on U.S. imports of $300 billion worth of automobiles.
Yeah, I think our editorial was titled "The Attack of the Killer Audis." One of the problems with the threat to impose auto tariffs is that it's probably illegal because importing a Mercedes is not really a national security threat. Set aside the fact that places like South Carolina, Tennessee, have a lot of employment thanks to foreign auto companies that make cars there, companies like BMW, Nissan, et cetera. But Dan, you're raising an important point, which is that there was political pressure here in the United States to ease off of these tariffs and this trade war because we need the European Union on side. For so many reasons, because between the two of us, we account for more than 50% of global GDP. You want that prosperity to continue because you can't have a strong defense without a strong economy, but also because we need the European Union to help us really address truly unfair trading practices. And I'm thinking specifically of China. And that was part of what President Trump talked about on Wednesday. He made a little noticed reference to reforming the World Trade Organization. Dan, that sounded to me like a direct threat to finally address some of the real problems that we have with the global trading structure.
That could very well be what's in store. But I would say, the president is in a bit of a pickle because he has opened up a multi-front trade war, and where there is some plausibility to the notion that we need to get tough with China. Certainly with the Europeans and the Canadians and Mexicans and everybody else, it's not so much the case. So if President Trump can achieve a peace with the Europeans so that they're not wooable by the Chinese are making overtures to everybody around the world, recognizing that the United States is sort of isolated and it appears to be an international scofflaw. So I see this strategic in that sense. The WTO, the Trump administration's concerns about that are kind of bogus. I mean, they really, it starts with Lighthizer, who sees the WTO as being anti-American. And
this is the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer.
That's correct. And he, you know, he's a former trade lawyer. Some of his, the issues that he adjudicated in the United States in trade courts here were found to violate U.S. commitments under the WTO agreements over the years. So he has a personal vendetta, I think, against the WTO. The fact is that the WTO's dispute settlement body is as fair as they come. Complainants win about 90% of the time. When the United States is a complainant, it wins about 90% of the time. When it's a defendant, it loses about 90% of the time. Likewise, that's the case for everybody else. But look, the WTO can afford to be reformed. They've failed for over 20 years at achieving a new round of trade liberalization. And so we need to see progress made there. We need to make the organization a little bit more flexible so that we can pass new clauses without requiring consensus from everybody, maybe have a majority vote. We need to unravel the problem besetting the what's called the appellate body, the Supreme Court of the WTO. It's a problem that has been caused by the United States, which is failing to lend support to any new nominees.
So it's unclear then if President Trump, in saying we're going to reform the WTO, is going to move in a positive market opening direction or go in the other way. Okay, fine. No. We set that aside. I want to go through some of the other things that the president and Juncker promised to do. You mentioned working towards zero tariffs, but that doesn't include automobiles, so there's no open question there. There's the WTO issue. The president also said that he was going to start what he called a close dialogue on standards. This has always been a sticking point for the United States. Why is it so hard to get Brussels to adopt standards, regulatory standards, that are in line and copacetic with U.S. standards?
Well, we have two different cultures. Actually, the European Union has many different cultures, and they tend to lean more in favor of regulation than the U.S. system does. And this was a sticking point in the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership negotiations. There tends to be this perception from the European left that achieving some sort of regulatory harmonization or coherence with the United States amounts to a race to the bottom. It amounts to adopting, you know, low labor standards and environmental standards and product safety standards. Whereas the right in the United States sees regulatory coherence as acceding to these impossible regulatory standards that squelch business formation and reduce profits. In fact, there are lots of regulations and lots of standards that could be harmonized through mutual recognition without compelling either side to necessarily change its rules, but giving business the flexibility to adhere to either side, whether you're European or American or foreign, to figure out a way to, in order to have economies of scale. Right now, if you have to produce something for two markets, and the differences in regulations, per se, an electrical cord, you need a 3-foot cord in the United States and a 1-meter length cord in Europe for an appliance. They're both trying to achieve the same outcome, some safety outcome. I don't think those 3 inches really make that much of a difference. Those are the kinds of things we could say, look, either one works. And I think that there are many, many regulations afflicting business where business would rather even adhere to a more costly set of regulations, provided they only had to adhere to one.
So there's a lot of room then to compromise and to negotiate over things like standards. The other notable item that was mentioned in that press conference, Dan, that I wanted to get your view on, was President Trump's commitment to basically export more liquefied natural gas or LNG to the European Union. He claimed in typical Trumpian fashion, quote, they're going to be a very, very big buyer, end quote. First of all, I'm thrilled about that because you want our closest allies to have energy security, particularly when you have the Germans going off and doing deals with Moscow to become more reliant on Russian LNG. That struck me as is good news if indeed it becomes reality.
Yeah, I think that there is a global market for these kinds of products, energy products. There's a global market for agricultural products like soy. What we're seeing is the Chinese retaliating to U.S. protection by targeting soy, U.S. soy farmers and LNG exporters. So those industries are getting hit hard in this trade war. And Trump is signaling to the Europeans, I think, hey, do your part to pick up the slack here. And by the way, what we've negotiated, what we've decided at this meeting on Wednesday, is that we won't impose any new tariffs while these negotiations are going on. But we still have this investigation of the auto situation, and we could still levy tariffs on you.
But that isn't legal, is it, Dan? I mean, there is no national security threat from importing an Audi.
Absolutely. No national security threat at all. There's no national security threat regarding imports of steel and aluminum either. But it just so happens that that statute, Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, gives the president broad latitude, the most latitude, to define a national security threat and to come up with a plan to mitigate that threat. Congress didn't anticipate a President Trump when that law was passed. And now there are efforts in Congress to try to recapture some of the congressional constitutional authority by reining in the president, by requiring votes on remedies before they happen, to do an economic impact study before imposing tariffs, things like that. It's not that it's illegal. It seems to be legal, and the courts tend to be deferential to the president on matters of security and immigration, and we're in a bit of a pickle here. So,
well, again, that's another political reason for the White House to declare a truce with the European Union, cool some of those political tensions back in Washington, and get our allies on side. I'm going to try to be hopeful here. I'm not usually on this podcast, but let's try. We're talking about the U.S.-EU trade war truce, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary here in New York with Dan Eikenson, the director of the Cato Institute's Trade Policy Study Center in Washington. And we are turning back to our hemisphere because the Trump administration may have cooled tensions with the European Union over trade. But what about Mexico and Canada? Remember those NAFTA trade negotiations? Well, Canada's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, met with her Mexican counterpart just this week, didn't hit the headlines, but we noticed here at Foreign Edition, and said that the two parties were, quote, committed to modernizing NAFTA as a trilateral agreement, end quote. Dan, where are we in these negotiations? They've really fallen out of the headlines, but this is a major source of economic prosperity and security, economic security, for all three nations. So where does it stand?
Yes, I agree with you. The North American production platform is necessary to compete effectively with the Asian and European competitors, and we are really tempting fate by leaving it open and leaving all this uncertainty. And the negotiations were reopened last year. They seemed to be making some progress, but reports of the progress varied depending on whom you spoke with. They have been on hiatus pretty much since the United States, since the Trump administration levied the aluminum and steel tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Now we have a new president in Mexico who has said that he is committed to continuing the work of renegotiating the NAFTA. Robert Lighthizer seems to be having a hard time convincing Christina Freeland and the Mexicans that he wants certain things in the NAFTA that really are poison pills, specifically an expiration clause, a sunset clause. His view is that trade agreements should expire unless they are reaffirmed by votes in by all three of the countries. The problem with that is that it just creates an environment of uncertainty. Who's going to invest for the long term if every 5 years you need to reopen the agreement? Who's going to invest in business relationships and infrastructure, et cetera? So the Canadians have been most forceful in their opposition to that. And so Lighthizer has been saying things like, well, we're going to get this done, but we may have to get it done by striking a deal with the Mexicans first, and that will, you know, open the eyes of the Canadians as to what they're missing.
It's like the Bluto approach. Now it's time for a really stupid and futile gesture. Thank you, Mr. Lighthizer. We really appreciate that. My goodness, only an idea that a lawyer could come up with. So, Dan, you talked about poison pills. Clearly, the sunset clause is one of them. But the president has also talked about inking bilateral agreements with Canada and with Mexico. The statement from Chrystia Freeland this week seems to indicate that they are not interested in that, that they are going to negotiate a trilateral deal or no deal at all. That sounds right to me, but what say you?
Yes, I think that makes the most sense as well. I mean, my preference is for all countries in the world to be on the same page and have the same rules. The more governments and the more people and businesses operating under the same set of rules, the lower the cost of production, the lower the cost for consumers. That's what you want. When you have a bunch of bilateral agreements, what you have is a whole companion set of rules that need to be adhered to in order to qualify for the terms of the agreement. So to get duty-free treatment, for example, you know, your rules of origin require certain amounts of value added being conducted in the countries within the free trade zone or materials originating in that zone. And it becomes some trade diversionary to some extent. And it certainly adds a lot of business costs. So the more the better. This administration has expressed its preference for bilaterals a number of times because they have this, they're haunted by this view that when we negotiate with multiple countries, as we had in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we bailed out of, that the other 11 are ganging up on the United States and that we have maximum leverage when it's just one-on-one. Well, that might have some ring of truth to it. I mean, I don't think that they're ganging up on us. I think the coalition shift issue by issue in these negotiations. There's not really any ganging up going on, and there's not much more leverage you have when it's just one-on-one. And what you're trading off is larger markets. You're going to spend the entirety of your 4 years in office or 8 years in office negotiating trade agreements doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
That's putting it very nicely. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I would also think that the Trump base would want Mexico and Canada to be as prosperous as possible, particularly Mexico, because they're so concerned about immigration, illegal immigration over the border. We are concerned about that as well. But what we've seen over the last two decades is that as Mexico has become more prosperous, there's less incentive for that illegal immigration to occur. And in fact, the bulk of it that you see now is coming from the really poor Central American countries. You know, you don't see the vast numbers of single adult Mexican males coming over the border any way they can to work, make money, and go home. So there's a political incentive there. To keep NAFTA in place and to strengthen it and to open it up even more.
Right. Well, look, I mean, if you're concerned about immigration competing for jobs, if you're a blue collar worker, I don't know that the data necessarily support that. But where you have to legitimately worry is if we don't have free trade with Mexico and Canada, you know, half the value of our imports in the United States are intermediate goods.
What does that mean? That sounds like jargon to some listeners.
Yeah, they're inputs used by U.S. manufacturers. So upstream products like steel and aluminum and chemicals and rubber that go into manufacturing products. So if we all of a sudden have a 10% tariff on steel with Mexico on a, you know, perpetually, that, you know, the cost of production in the United States goes up. And if it's now harder for us to export our finished products to Mexico, our revenues go down. So manufacturing costs of production go up and the revenues go down. So the profits get squeezed from both ends. And if you have fewer profits, how are you going to fund expansion, hiring, and wage increases?
Our national defense.
And that as well.
Yeah. Dan, is there a hard deadline here that the three parties have to meet?
No, there's not. There was talk of a hard deadline to get NAFTA done before the administration had to seek renewal of trade promotion authority. That's already passed. The new president is sworn in, I think, in November or December. So there's talk of using that as the benchmark that we need to get it done before he's sworn in.
That's Andres Manuel López Obrador, Mexico's
AMLO.
Incoming. Yeah, AMLO.
Yeah, the administration needs to notify Congress 90 days in advance that it has signed an agreement so that Congress can then review it and do its due diligence before it votes on it. So an agreement would have to be done by, I think the estimate is by the end of August, like 30 days, in order for it to be signed into a treaty by the end of the year.
Well, now that we've declared a truce with Europe, maybe they can devote more energy to getting the NAFTA renegotiation done. Let's hope so. Unfortunately, that's it. We are out of time. On behalf of Dan Eikenson at Cato, thanks to him for being on the show today. Thanks to you guys for listening. We'll be back with you on Monday.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.